Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this press briefing by the World Health Organization from our headquarters in Geneva on Ebola outbreak and response in Democratic Republic of the Congo. We welcome journalists who are here in a room with us, but also we welcome all those who are watching us live on WHO Twitter account. I will give a floor immediately to our Deputy Director General for Emergency Preparedness and Response, Dr. Peter Salama, who has just returned from his second visit to Democratic Republic of the Congo to share with us news on this situation and the response that is being done by the government and partners. Dr. Salama.
Thanks so much, Tarek, and welcome for those of you who could join us today. As Tarek said, I'm just back this morning from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was there for 2 days, really to visit with the Ministry of Health, discuss with the national and local authorities on the progress in the outbreak and its response, to meet with community leaders, to meet with our international partners from the UN and NGO, and to assess with our teams in real depth the progress on the outbreak response and to develop scenarios and planning and any adjustments required to the response to date. I'm going to show a few slides, so I apologize for those of you joining on Twitter to make sure that somehow you get access to these, but I'll explain them as I go, so perhaps that will help you follow the slides. So the first update is really on the data, where we always start. There are 62 cases now, 38 confirmed and 27 deaths. Most notably, there's a new confirmed case as of yesterday in the health zone of Iboko. And that's from the known contact list. And that had a date of onset of symptoms of June the 2nd. So that's important to recognize that the outbreak is ongoing and particularly in and around Iboko. Next slide, please. This slide shows the epidemic curve. And this is the overall epidemic curve. In red are the confirmed cases. And for those of you joining us online, basically what the slide shows is that the majority of confirmed cases really were 2 or 3 weeks ago in a major cluster, and since then there's been sporadic confirmation of cases. This slide is perhaps even more important than the previous one because it seeks to disaggregate the outbreak into the three major areas of foci. So the first row we're showing is Bikoro, and you can see that the last red box, so the last confirmed case in Bikoro, was in around the middle of May. If you turn to the bottom row, you can see similarly for the area of Wangata, so that zone in Bandaka, that the last case was the 13th of May. So no confirmed cases in Bikoro or Wangata. That's really important because basically what that is telling us is that the response is having an impact in those two locations, and we can be increasingly cautiously optimistic that we're protecting that big town of Bandaka and the small town of Bikoro. But the middle row is perhaps the most important for today's discussion, as we're entering the one-month anniversary, if you like, of the outbreak being declared. You can see that middle row, and there are still confirmed cases to the end of May and then on the 2nd of June, as I've described earlier, in Iboko. And that tells us a lot about why we need to refocus this response on the areas of Iboko, and I'll talk about that a bit later on. So here is just another graphical representation on a map of the confirmed, suspected and probable cases, and you can see that the majority of cases now are clearly with 32 in Iboko, followed by Bikoro after that, but remembering that many of those cases in Bikoro are now old. Many of you were asking for contact tracing data, so I wanted to give you some today, since it's the last time I spoke to you. Overall, the contact tracing has been a huge challenge, and particularly a challenge in the areas that are hardest to reach. You can see that in Bikoro, the contact tracing performance is now very good. It's improved rapidly over the last couple of weeks. And equally, even in the most difficult locations, such as Iboko, we're seeing quite good performance. There are gaps in Bandaka, and they relate to a lot of old cases where it's been very hard to trace even once the original contact. So there is a gap in that contact tracing in Bandaka that we're still trying to address. But overall, the performance of 91% on 619 contacts. I wanted to give you a flavour of some of the very detailed epidemiological work that is ongoing in the outbreak response. This is called chain of transmission documentation. And you can see there is a coloured-coded graph here that describes cases in Iboko in green, in Bikoro in blue, and in Wangata in orange. And basically it just shows you, on one hand, how the different chains of transmission are interrelated. So there's overlap between contacts, there's overlap between cases and at-risk contacts. But equally, each chain of transmission can become a self-propagating chain of transmission that acts then independently of others. You can see why we're always concerned about a single case being the start of a super-spreading event. And you can see in green those cases on the left-hand side of the slide in Iboko, where it was associated with a nurse who treated formally and informally a lot of different people in hospital and at their home. And you could see that that resulted, as she became Ebola positive, in what we call a super-spreading event, an event that led to a lot of additional cases. So it only takes one case to travel and one event to result in another major upsurge in cases. And that's why we still remain hyper-vigilant, even in Bandaka and Bikoro, where we're more optimistic. I wanted to end with just a couple of photos from yesterday. This is Patrice, who I met yesterday in Itipo. He is a survivor from a treatment centre run by MSF in Bikoro, and he was discharged around a week ago now, and he's been recruited as one of our staff working for contact tracing and supporting as well the vaccination and the treatment facility in Itipo. You can see by his face that he's actually pretty happy, and he really is pretty happy. I had one more slide about forest, but it's not there. Okay, I'll stop there and maybe just end with a couple of big picture points about where we are in the outbreak on month one. So in summary, there's been very strong progress in the outbreak response, particularly in relation to two of the initial three sites, Bandaka, that urban centre which we were most concerned about, and Bikoro. We have added cause for optimism because now we've reached, for the majority of the contacts, more than 98% of the contacts with vaccination. And because the vaccination for the majority of them occurred more than 10 days ago, we believe that the majority of those contacts in the ring vaccination are now protected against Ebola. So that gives us a lot of source for optimism, along with the fact that we haven't seen cases since mid-May in those two locations. So phase one, protect urban centres and towns, has gone well, and we can be cautiously optimistic. Now we're into phase two, and this is really what we need to do for the next few weeks in terms of focus. The focus of the response now has to turn to these rural isolated communities in Iboko and Itipo. They're all under Iboko Health Zone. The challenge is quite a different one there. We're talking about some of the most remote territory on Earth. We're talking about forested areas. We're talking about populations that are more than 50% indigenous populations and already marginalized populations who have to be reached with community engagement strategies and social mobilization. And we're talking about an enormous logistical effort required to reach every alert of a case, and then if there is a confirmation of a case, every contact on contact of those cases. And what does that mean in reality? It means further strengthening our operational bases now in Itipo and Iboko. We now have 80 people in Itipo, for example, remembering that Itipo is a tiny, tiny village with a mission and no infrastructure. So no power, no electricity, no running water in the middle of the forest. We are sleeping now, our staff, around 15 to 20 to a tent, and the infrastructure is only beginning to catch up. The motorcycles are starting to arrive. It's not even territory that can be covered by four-wheel drives. It's really motorcycle terrain. And we're talking about several hours to trace each and every contact. So this is a major logistical and boots-on-the-ground epidemiological effort now to trace every one of these cases and contacts. And that tough work is going to go on for the next few weeks, especially given we've had a case as recently as yesterday confirmed. So that's where we are with the outbreak. So we're cautiously optimistic, but there's a lot of very tough work to do in phase two before we can say that we're on the top of this outbreak. And we've learnt the hard way in the past never to underestimate Ebola. I'll stop there and pause for questions.
Thank you very much, Salama. So we have 240 people watching us live. Mostly these are journalists. Please, if you have some comments or questions, send a line to our Twitter account, and we will try, knowing that we will not maybe be able to take all the questions. So maybe we'll start here in a room before I ask a few questions that I received from some media over email.
Okay, if I can, Tom Miles from Reuters. I've got a few questions, but I'll just try you on. If there hadn't been a vaccine campaign, what sort of size of the outbreak would we be looking at now, do you think? You know, how much difference has this made? And do you think that we're going to get a chance to test the treatments? Because, I mean, as far as I know, the treatments haven't started yet, and that presumably takes some time. But will we ever get a chance to actually try these in a live situation?
Great. Should we take a couple?
John, would you like
to? Yeah, fine.
Great. Shall I start with those then? So on the size of the outbreak, it's very hard to predict in advance, Tom, how big this outbreak may or may not have been minus vaccination. We will be doing and have done already some modelling exercises. We will do some post-outbreak as well, and we'll try and quantify some of those parameters. But I would say, even from now, that it's extremely likely that the vaccine has had a positive impact. The quantification remains to be done post-outbreak. On tests of treatment, so as you know, four of the five therapeutic options are now available in country in DRC. So they're there, and several of them are even available on site in the towns that are hosting Ebola treatment units. So the question really is more one of clinical decision-making. So we've had a confirmed case today. I'm sure that's going to provoke a discussion amongst the clinicians in Bikoro Treatment Center with the MOH and Congolese physicians and the Ethics Review Committee, the Scientific Review Committee, I should say, of which could be the most appropriate drug and is it indicated at the moment. So that's very much a clinical and scientific case-by-case decision at the moment, but the drugs are ready to go, and so it's up to the clinicians.
So just having one patient trying a drug is enough to give you knowledge for that clinical trial?
So at the moment, we're using the drugs under something called compassionate use, not under a clinical research protocol, and really the major aim is to carefully monitor the use, but for the purposes of improving the treatment outcomes and survival.
Thank you. I will just read and ask two questions on behalf of our colleague Carly Petesh from Associated Press Africa Bureau. I think some of his questions have been answered, but he has two that I think we didn't touch upon yet. What's WHO risk assessment regarding the risk of spread? Is it still very high within the region, and what about international spread? And second question was why aren't people like taxi and motorcycle drivers who transport Ebola patients being offered the Ebola vaccine?
Okay. So on the first, the formal risk assessment from WHO has not changed. So it's very high at national level, high at regional level, and low at international level. And we haven't changed that status yet. We will, over the coming weeks, look at reviewing that status and depending on the trends in the outbreak, make necessary modifications. But as I said, we're still extremely concerned about proximity to Congo River of cases. As you can see on the map, even cases around Iboko, not far from lakes and tributaries of the Congo River. So that remains a major risk factor. And we know that people travel very extensively through the forests in this area, and so cases can show up in very many locations. So we won't be changing for the next few days at least, but in the future we will certainly revise as needed. Taxi drivers and motorcycle drivers, well, they certainly are considered to be vaccinated, but in the context of the ring vaccination program, what we do is we look at the confirmed cases and then we identify the contacts of those confirmed cases and the contacts of the contacts. So if those contacts happen to be taxi or motorcycle riders, then they will be vaccinated under the existing protocol. So they're certainly not excluded.
You touched upon this, but the Associated Press had one more question, and maybe we could reiterate. Question is, how confident is WHO that surveillance is picking up all potential cases? Are there unknown chains of transmission WHO is worried about?
So this is the hardest work in this outbreak response, and it's to document every single chain of transmission. And so far, we have documented a large number of chains of transmission. We are not in a position, though, to say that we've documented every chain of transmission, because, as I said, this is a remote, rural, isolated area of the world, and there's still a lot more epidemiological work to do to really complete that full picture and epidemiological narrative to be able to know that we have that entire view. So not yet. There may still be unknown chains out there, and there may still be surprises in this outbreak.
Thank you very much. Do we have Tom, please?
I wanted to follow up on the same question because I wanted to ask specifically about the city in Bandaka.
Yes.
How confident are you that you know what has happened there? And you know, I know there are only a small number of patients, but they had the lowest in your contact tracing figures. That was the low one, 77%, yeah. I think, had been checked today. Yeah. And presumably it's easier, well, it's relatively easy for somebody to go missing. How confident are you that you've really got the outbreak, sorted there?
So, again, I would use the phrase cautiously optimistic, Tom, because we've only seen 4 confirmed cases. It's a relatively well-defined urban center. Everyone is on heightened alert in terms of surveillance. So if there were any additional cases of all the locations, this is the location most likely for additional cases to be quickly confirmed and then brought to treatment, as opposed to some of the rural isolated communities where it might take days for us to find out. So given no confirmed cases since mid-May, given we vaccinated, we believe, a large proportion of the contacts through ring vaccination, we're cautiously optimistic. Now, could there be a case that is unknown or either travels to Bandaka from another region in coming days? Absolutely, yes.
Yes, John.
Hi, Peter, I was wondering, you mentioned the 5 drugs you're about to send for treatment.
Yes.
What's the efficacy level of these drugs for patients, basically, and what are the 5 drugs that you are going to treat?
Okay. Now, I have Vazzy here, who's our specialist in this area, so maybe I'll hand over the floor directly to you.
Sure. So there are 4 drugs that are in country now. Clearly, there are...
Need the mic, Vazzy.
Oh, please. Shall I go there?
Just give me a minute.
There are 4 unlicensed drugs that are in country. So importantly, there are no drugs that are licensed for Ebola virus disease. It's true that the status of the pipeline has progressed over the last few years, partly prompted by research that was conducted during the 2014 to 2015 epidemic. We do have a list on our website, which is the outcome of the independent scientific committee that we constituted their assessment of the evidence, because it's really important to look at that evidence. So I would point you to the statement on our website, which provides a summary of the evidence. There's a priority list on that statement, which is in order of the evidence for those drugs.
And the top 4 on that list are the ones you've sent to the DRC?
It's not the top 4. We're looking into the import of the one of them. So it's not that they're the top 4. It's 4 of the 5. It starts with Z. If you want me to go through the names, it starts with ZMAP, then it goes into GS5734. So ZMAP is a monoclonal antibody. GS5734 is an antiviral. And then there's a Regeneron product, which is another monoclonal antibody. And then there's something called MAB114. They're not very memorable names, I'm afraid, which was has been developed by NIH.
They're all online, though, John.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the efficacy levels in experimental phase?
So, because it's clearly very difficult to evaluate efficacy of Ebola products in outbreaks for obvious reasons. There are not many cases. It's been difficult in the past to conduct these trials. There is one randomized controlled trial that was published a couple of years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine with ZMAP, which really is the clinical efficacy data that we have with Ebola therapeutics. Most of the efficacy that we need to go by is non-human primate data, so monkey models. And there are good monkey models now where in these models, all of the monkeys die somewhere between day 6 and day 10 from being infected. And some of these treatments, when given as late as day 5, so the day before the monkeys would die, lead to very high protection of the monkeys. But there is more clinical safety data than there is clinical efficacy data, which is obviously very important as well.
Thank you very much. I don't hear... Well, Tom, please go ahead.
I'm sorry, I always have one question. One is, have you found the index case, and is that important to find the index case? The second question is, if a case pops up in Central African Republic, because it's a different government leading things, how quickly could you move to have a vaccination campaign and contact tracing and other things that you need to do on the ground?
Yeah. So on your first question, Tom, we do believe it's important to understand the whole epidemiological picture, including the index case. Now, the first priority is obviously to stop the outbreak. So as we're stopping the outbreak, we are collecting more and more information, and we're building up that historical picture of the outbreak. But the first priority, stop the outbreak, fill in the gaps as we go epidemiologically, and over the course of the next few weeks, I think we'll see a more complete picture of the chains of transmission, including the index case. But it's part of the work, but it's not the driving priority at the moment. That's certainly stopping the outbreak. In terms of the regional issues, including Central African Republic, as you may know, yesterday we released a regional emergency preparedness plan focused on 9 surrounding countries, and the priority one countries for that plan are Central African Republic and Republic of Congo. And the reason, of course, they're priority one are because they are closest to the current outbreak in Democratic Republic of Congo. And indeed, especially in the case of CAR, we're particularly concerned about the fact that the infrastructure is very poor in that country, and also that it's got its own enormous challenges being the subject of its own internal conflict. So one of the worst-case scenarios, indeed, would be having cases in Central African Republic. Fortunately, we've already sent preparedness support missions to 7 of the 9 surrounding countries, the ones that most need it. And those missions, as part of this regional response work, are really to look at the capacities and gaps in terms of national preparedness. So they look at the lab, they look at surveillance and data issues, they look at supply issues, including the availability of personal protective equipment, and they look at human resources as well and any needs for WHO to supplement the capacities existing in country. So that's been done for CAR. And you may also know that our Director General is travelling both to CAR and to the outbreak zone in DRC over the weekend. He'll arrive on Sunday in DRC. And so he'll be in CAR Monday and some of Tuesday. And he'll be looking at some of those issues with the authorities, including with the president, who was here actually in this room this week looking at the Ebola response and preparedness. So we have good active engagement at the highest level from the government of CAR, and we'll be certainly looking at any gaps that they have in their preparedness.
Thank you very much. As I don't see any more questions coming, we will we'll conclude here. I would also like to thank Dr. Vasi Morty, who is a research coordinator. If you need his full name and title, please send me an email and you will have it. Also, we will have an audio file from this briefing that will be shared to with our globalists. I thank very much Dr. Pete Salama for being with us despite the long travel hours you had. And wish everyone a nice weekend.
Thank you very much.